This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Some people follow the rules, but where's the fun in that? I'm Soraya, and this is Rule Breakers, the podcast where we celebrate the rebels, the risk takers, and the ones who make their own way. Every week, I sit down with the boldest voices in sports, entertainment, and beyond to talk about breaking barriers, defying expectations, and rewriting the rules. No limits, no apologies, just real talk. Follow and listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Anthony, you might have to pull that one from the rotation. Because while we loved our time when Ben Stanek was basically a co-host of the show once a week, things have changed. Luckily for all of us, for the better. There's plenty of magic being made by the team that we spend our time with now.
You're right. We might have to pull it.
Might have to. You know what we are going to do, though? We're going to talk to Ben Stanek.
Today's top story, from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not my beat.
Ben Stanek, Commanders beat reporter for The Athletic, back from the NFL owners' meetings. How are you, my friend?
Craig, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I'm not going to lie. I got used to 80 degrees for a couple of days, so, this is better than what it was a couple months ago here, but, not 80 degrees.
No, I was definitely very not happy with the fact that it was like 40 degrees this morning, especially because I had to go help a friend of ours move some furniture this morning. That, everyone's like, oh, you're so fit. And I'm like, yeah, it means you're the person that people call to help you move furniture. But no, I was happy to help move this thing. And I was going to bike over to their house. I walked outside and was like, looked at my wife. I was like, can you drop me off because it's on the way to work? Because it's too cold. So I'd imagine going from the 80 degrees, nicest hotel you'll go to all year for the owners' meetings, back to whatever greeted you this morning outside your home was not very pleasant.
It was not. But I think more importantly, what friends do you have that are using you to move stuff? Don't people use movers anymore? What are we doing?
No, they had to, they're getting their, like, they have movers coming because they're in the process of selling their house and they have to redo their stairs first. So it's like one of those situations, and it was just one dresser that needed to get moved down a couple flights, and we only took a small chunk out of their wall, so it was fine.
Fair enough.
You get what you pay for, and apparently my price should have gone down. Anyway, Ben, more importantly, you heard not only Dan Quinn, but Adam Peters speak the last couple days. DQ, and there's definitely interesting stuff to get into substantively there. But I feel like that was the most relaxed and most verbose we've heard Adam Peters speak in his entire time as the GM of the Commanders. How do you feel like he's settling into his second off season here? And what did you take away from Peters before we get to some of the things that Quinn said?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right on that. He in the midst of his conversation with us, he liked to sort of made a random joke about something he had just said, and he put a reporter quasi on the spot about it. And just the fact that he was able to sort of make a joke in the middle of it, not that he was like the most stiff guy ever, but just like it was a sign of some relaxation. And yeah, I mean, I think that he, in some of his responses, gave some decent answers, not a ton of specifics, but, he didn't just simply brush everything off and say, well, we're not going to talk about that or what have you. So, yeah, I thought he was pretty good. I mean, I think that, the Terry McLaurin stuff, in terms of possibly getting an extension, again, not a real surprise, but, he said, hey, yeah, we've had some dialogue, not going to get into any of it and preliminary things like that, but, just simply acknowledging that's a thing. I mean, I believe I asked that at the combine and didn't really get anywhere. So, yeah, I think there's some stuff like that made some sense. He talked a bit about Javon Kinlaw and the choice there and Debo as well. So, I thought he was, I thought he was good. I mean, relatively speaking, we can always get some more specifics out of them, but, yeah, I thought he was pretty good.
I will say, listening to him talk about Kinlaw, that is like one of the most animated I've ever heard him. He clearly loves Javon Kinlaw. How much do you think he's involved in whatever the plan for Kinlaw will be? Or is he just like, this dude's a rare piece of clay. DQ, I trust you to mold it.
Yeah, probably the latter. It does feel like, look, obviously as a general manager, you know, when it comes to making picks or signings, you know, the buck stops with him. But this one feels like the most sort of him going out on a limb to say, I got this, you know. Javon Kinlaw is the guy he drafted in the first round back in 2020. He's a massive human being. You know, it wasn't a wrong pick at the time, but then Kinlaw suffered a significant knee injury in 2021. He basically missed 2 years of football. He has come back the last two seasons and played all 34 games he was able to, and he started all 17 last year for the Jets, but he hasn't, you know, still come close to reaching the heights that I think people thought were conceivable. And he basically saying, Peters, that is saying, I think that's still in here. This is not a lost cause. He's still, got a lot of the physical traits. He obviously knows the guy. So it does feel like this is the one where he is putting his neck out a bit more, because it was definitely, I think we all can agree, a bit of a surprise, a curious signing in terms of the years and the money for a guy that, you know, wasn't typically being viewed as a sought-after free agent. And not that the 3 years, $45 million, 30 guaranteed is, you know, even if it doesn't work, it's not going to be some major blight on his resume. But at the same point, it was like the one, other than the two trades, it was the one free agent move that they went and did, you know, gave some real assets and a bit of a surprise, but he obviously sees the plan and, he gets benefit of the doubt, right, for the most part at this stage, and we'll see what happens.
Ben Standig with us from The Athletic here on The Hoffman Show. Of course, they're Commanders beat reporter. DQ talked a little bit more about some of the alignments that we've all been questioning. JP kind of did the same thing that I feel like my comments section is sometimes. Like, oh, where's this guy going to play? Where's Coleman going to play? And then is this guy going to slide here? How much do you think that they've really thought about that with this and are playing coy versus, no, they're really just going to try a bunch of stuff? Like, have you been able to gather any extra intel beyond the things that Quinn said directly yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think you always have to have a plan. You know, they emphasized competition last year. You know, one of the reasons they said why they didn't just tell us that Jaden Daniels was going to start all along was, you know, if you're going to just say he's the starter and you know, erase any notion of competition, even if it's minimal, then, you know, why aren't you doing that for all the other spots? So I do think they want to keep that up and have that be a real thing. And in terms of the offensive line, you know, I mean, my view all along has been presumably they're going to put him at right tackle and that Coleman is going to be, you know, his job to lose or to win, however you want to kind of look at that. With Andrew Wiley, though, still there. I mean, Andrew Wiley's been the starter the last couple of years. So if Coleman, you know, has a tough off-season training camp, then, you know, they can go back to Wiley and it's not set in stone. But, you know, I'm sure they, you know, did all this with the belief that, hey, we believe Coleman could be a left tackle, therefore we believe he could be a tackle, so now we're going to put him on the right side. And, you know, I think this is a potentially seismic opportunity for them, because if he's able to, he was okay last year, but, you know, gave up a fair amount of sacks and pressures. And, you know, if he's able to secure the right tackle spot with Tunsil around for the next few years, I mean, this offensive line could really jump significantly from where it was, you know, in the last year under Ron Rivera. So I think it's a pretty significant move. But, you know, in general, I think with all these moves, they have to have some idea what the plan, like, you know, same thing with cornerback, right? Quinn's saying Jonathan Jones, you know, they can play him inside or outside, and, you know, they're going to look at Sandersill sort of the same way. But it's hard to believe that you're not saying, okay, we believe that Sandersill is going to do X, and how do we complement that, you know? So I think they always have a plan, but, you know, they like options, and, you know, they're just not using the term position flex the way that somebody else may have. And I think from that, therefore, we're not getting beat over the head with a term, but they are kind of saying the same thing. We want to have guys that can do different things, but, you know, we have a plan as to what we think that's going to look like. But we're giving ourselves outs, and, you know, in terms of case of injuries or just things don't work out.
Ben standing with us here on the Hoffman Show. Last thing for you, Ben, off the board from the owners' meetings. You are renowned, sir, for your correct mock drafting over the years. And so I want to quickly just ask you one thing about the mock that you did last week. You do have the Commanders trading back like many fans want, although it's not necessarily in the way that a lot of people think that'll go down. A lot of people are like, oh, they've, you know, some team will want a quarterback and want to trade up. And you actually have a team trading up way ahead of the Commanders, up to 24 to take Jackson Dart. Like, how realistic is, like, obviously the Commanders are going to want to trade down because they'd like to recoup the draft capital. And we all know that at that point in the draft, there's probably not a whole bunch of difference between the caliber of player you'll get at 29 versus the one that you'll get at 34, 35. So how many teams do you think are going to be looking to trade up, whether it's for quarterback or something else, that you feel like this is a plausible situation? And kind of is part B related of that question, like, how high do you think some of these, like the Giants, et cetera, will think they have to go to ensure that they get the third quarterback off the board? And in other words, is Washington going to be too late for that in the first round?
Yeah, no, I think they definitely could be too late in the first round if we're just talking about a quarterback. I think a lot's going to depend on what happens with Shedeur Sanders. I mean, obviously he could go off the board at 2 or 3, but if he gets past the Browns and the Giants, then I don't know where he goes. I know a lot of people point to the Steelers at 21. For the moment, they don't even have, you know, much of a quarterback beyond Mason Rudolph. And even if they sign Aaron Rodgers, which is still the assumption, and, you know, he's obviously not a long-term plan. But, you know, we'll see. It feels to me like Pittsburgh, you know, is trying to be aggressive now. They didn't make that DK Metcalf trade for 3 years from now. So, you know, are they going to use a first-round pick? They don't have a second on a quarterback? I don't know. So if they don't, now all of a sudden, you know, Sanders and Dart are in there in the 20s, and things could get more interesting. But if Sanders is gone before Pittsburgh, then you got to look at Pittsburgh at 21 as possibly being where you have to jump. So, yeah, it is possible that Washington's a little too far back. We'll see. But I think you can always look at some of the other premium positions. I think the one I had was, I think I had the Browns trading up. I think I forgot what happened yesterday, but I think I had the Browns trading up to get Ohio State offensive tackle Josh Simmons, who, you know, was probably viewed as like a higher first round pick, but he had a knee injury last year. And, you know, like if you're going to, you know, if your team like the Browns, you know, you know, if you're going to, whether you take a quarterback at 2 or not, you know, you got to shore up the main positions. And, you know, that one, or it could be a pass rusher. You know, those are the type of spots that teams could still be interested in. There's a lot of teams in this draft that have 10 or more picks, the Browns being one of them. And if this draft is not considered to be, you know, particularly robust, and free agency wasn't either, it does kind of make some sense for teams to say, hey, we have all this draft capital. Rather than bring in 10, 11 guys, let's trade some of that, get the better players that we like, and go that way. So I think that's conceivable. And, you know, lastly, look, Adam Peters, like, you know, he's not great at, again, none of these guys are, about giving too many specifics, but he just said flat out, look, if I could trade down every year, I would. And I don't think that's just him being, like, flipping. I think that's the reality. So I think he's in. It's just a matter of,
right,
you know, does the board fall a certain way that, you know, they can take advantage of it?
100%. If every team wants to trade down, then it's kind of hard to trade down because then no one wants to trade up. So you got to have a willing partner, and it's got to work out for you on the value side of it. And that is the challenge of it all. And that's why Adam Peters, amongst other reasons, paid a whole lot of money. Ben Stanig, he gets paid not as much as Adam Peters, I presume. If you are, Ben, I need to come work for The Athletic. But you do great work for the money that you make over there at The Athletic, where Ben is, of course, writing on everything Commanders, also doing a ton of mock draft work. And Ben's super plugged in on the agent side of things, so it's always really interesting to read his perspective this time of year. Ben, appreciate your time here on the radio, my friend, and I'm sure I'll be seeing you here sooner rather than later with the draft around the corner.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your guys' patience for having me on, and yeah, look forward to talking again.
Sounds good. Ben Stanig, everybody, with us here on The Hoffman Show. When we get back, let's get you a little bit more from DQ at the Coach's Breakfast yesterday, and then coming up at 5:30, Ben's colleague, the great David Aldridge at The Athletic, wrote a really fascinating article about the current state of the NBA and why, while the players are more skilled and frankly better basketball players than ever, the game doesn't seem quite as healthy as you think that would mean. We'll dive into that at 5:30 here on the Team 980. It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Anthony, you're into this 808 hitting.
Sail. Yeah.
It's a good song. It's a good song. Coming up at 5:30, we'll talk about David Aldridge's article on the state of the NBA. Very, 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 very interesting. We'll get into that in a second. Anthony, I'm afraid that this leadership bite from Quinn is like 5 minutes long. Is that correct? The file size suggests that it's very... Here, I'm gonna hit play on it and make sure it's on. Yeah, no, it's 5 minutes and 14 seconds. That feels like a bad cut. I know you didn't cut this audio.
No. Good gracious. That is a long cut.
Which sucks because I would love to play that. Instead, we'll get you a little bit more of Dan Quinn on some things and more digestible bites, including... Quinn talking about, I think, what is still the number one piece of, or the number one complaint by Commanders fans this offseason. What are you going to do about the run defense? So Dan Quinn, what are you going to do about the run defense?
There's a lot of things that we want to get better at, and that's our expectation. So run defense was certainly part of that. I think you look at the full circle of it, you know, like, what can we do better from a scheme standpoint? You know, how do we position the players in the right spots to do that better? And so we just want to take, you know, a different lens and a different view at everything. And what did we do well and what did we need to work on? And so that's what a lot of the time in the offseason is spent on, whether it's run defense or, you know, a certain part of, you know, all three phases. And we work really hard at that. So that's still an ongoing process, you know, looking at other teams as well, you know, who did things well, you know, who didn't. So we really take a deep dive on the things that need our most attention.
So this is what I think is like one of the more fascinating parts about this offseason for Washington and what happens for them moving forward. For the most part, I think they have, well, actually, let's go through it. Anthony, I'm enlisting your help here. Defensive end. Okay, we're not trying to say, are you great, right? But are you simply better than last year? Do you think their defensive end rotation is better now than it was last season?
Situationally, maybe. I feel like...
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like when it comes to the run game, we didn't have necessarily the best defensive end group. That's why we end up moving DeRon Payne to the edge, you know, to help slow it down. Dante Fowler, he was one of the guys that, you know, was... getting sacks, but in the run game was sort of kind of, you know, getting thrown out the way and things of that nature. So I think situationally we beefed up. We got guys that can, you know, defend the run because that was a huge problem last year. But in terms of rushing the passer,
I think you're probably worse.
Yeah.
Right. So I think overall they're better on the edge than they were last year. Again, that's not a very high bar. It's one of the weaknesses of the team. You've lost Dante Fowler, which means you've lost your best pass rusher. But Dietrich Wise is a massive upgrade. In terms of first and second down play. Furl now goes back a role. John Baptiste should not be forgotten about. He's in his second year. And Kinlaw is somewhere in that rotation, a guy that they're going to put on the end. And I think if he's given a specific role as that kind of player, like, his good is really, really good. Like, his good is elite. He doesn't produce it often enough to be an elite player. But like, when he decides to put his face into somebody and run through them, he is like... he's a rhinoceros, bro. Like, he's built different. And so if on third down, it's going to look very different than Fowler, and maybe he doesn't put up the sack totals, but if you just put him out there and you're like, hey, man, compress the pocket. There ain't a lot of dudes who can do what Javon Kinlaw can do in that way. So I'm going to say overall they are slightly better, acknowledging that they've taken a hit in terms of pass rush juice because Fowler was their best actual pass rusher. Interior. I think they're better than they were last year. And people can say they lost John Allen. And even if you're higher on John Allen than I am, John Allen didn't play most of the year last year. So that's not me trying to hate on John Allen. It's simply that Allen was hurt most of the year and didn't play a lot. So if Kinlaw, Payne, and Newton just play most of 2025, and Newton is better in year two than he was in year one, especially since he's not going to, you know, hopefully, he's starting the year healthy. Presuming that's the case, as opposed to missing all of the offseason last year as a rookie, like, they're better on the interior, not to mention guys like Eddie Goldman coming in, so they have some different body types, etc. So, and they brought back their depth guys, Sheldon Day, on down. And this is also a very deep defensive tackle class. They could add someone at any number of rounds. So do we agree they're better on the interior?
Yeah.
Okay. Linebacker. Hopefully they're flat, because otherwise it means Bobby regressed. And as long as Bobby's Bobby and Frankie's Frankie, and then you add in whatever Dominique Hampton gives you, whatever Jordan McGee gives you, hopefully you're better this year than you were last year, because you've got a little more depth, a little more speed. And then the secondary, I do think that you can make an argument they took a step back, because Will Harris is probably not as good of a football player as Jeremy Chinn. There's a chance he's not that much worse, and if Lattimore is better in year two, and Sainer still makes a jump in year two, and Jonathan Jones is better than Noah Igbinoghene, and by the way, Noah's here is another depth piece, and does Percy Butler make a jump in year two, Quan Martin make a jump in year two in the system, like, they could be better in the secondary, but if I'm being really harsh, like, they probably take some small step back personnel-wise because of the downgrade from Chinn to Harris. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Especially if we're talking about playing the run. Because Chinn was very good at that. And it wasn't necessarily what I was talking about. But the idea that they're like so much worse than they were last year, I think is actually incorrect. I actually think they're overall better than they were last year. The question then becomes, like, what's that worth? Because they weren't that good last year, defensively, specifically against the run. And so is... But the thing is, like, the way they were bad was not down in, down out horrendousness. They just stopped. They couldn't stop giving up big runs. They'd be really, really good for 2.5 quarters and then give up, you know, two runs of 20 yards. And you're like, well, there goes the average. There goes the cap you had on the game. So if being a little bit better means that the explosive plays shrink and you're just as consistent on the other downs, like, now a little bit goes a long way. So is that the optimistic spin? Admittedly, yeah. But I am curious to see how that actually functionally plays out. And I don't think it's an outrageous, like, huge leap to say that they actually might have gotten better on defense. And then we'll see what that means to go from the 20s into the... Or even the late 20s, or 27th or whatever they were, to 22nd or 18th. Like, what does that do overall to the defense?
Yeah, and I feel like in terms of the defense, if we limit those explosives and we force teams to do 10, 12, 13 play drives, then I think that'll fall more in our favor. So I think it also just speaks to a scheme thing. You limit those explosives, and that's what every team wants to do, limit the explosives. So the more we can do that, I think the better off we'll have, because there's not too many teams that's going to nickel and dime you the entire you know, way down the field.
And by the way, the number one culprit of the big plays was probably St. Juice.
Yeah.
And he's gone. So if he cannot, now Lattimore gave up his fair share in certain games, but if Juice is not holding on 3rd and 10 because he just has a meltdown mentally, and you're like, what are you doing, my guy? Mm-hmm. You were so good for so long, and now it's 3rd and 10, and you're on the opposite side of the play, and you grabbed a dude's face mask for what?
Or you let a guy run just right by you.
Yeah, or like, hey, it's 3rd and 10. They're probably gonna run straight. Yeah, if they can get that straightened out, then it would seem like the defense is in a better place. So just food for thought here on April 2nd. It's Off and Show. We're on the Team 980. We're always live as well on the free Odyssey app. David Aldridge wrote a great column in The Athletic where he talked to a bunch of the NBA's best about the current state of the game. Why the players might be better than ever, but the game is struggling. And it really gets down to a fundamental question. What do we want from our sports? And what does this have to do with torpedo bats in baseball? I'll connect the dots next. Nats trying to rally in the top of the 9th. They got some runners on. In fact, now the winning run coming, or the potential leading run coming to the plate, 4-2, top 9. I believe there are 2 outs up there in Toronto. So we'll see if the Nats come out to come back. And at the very least, fourth, bottom of the 9th, if not extra innings. Yeah, they got 2 on, 2 out with, let's see who's coming to the plate. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Show me home plate. Well, we'll let you know what happens because they're taking too long. We're going to talk a little hoops now, though, and we'll keep you updated on the Nats game live here as we go. But the Hall of Famer David Aldridge wrote a terrific column in The Athletic, Anthony, as part of an ongoing series that publication is doing about issues in the NBA. They've written about some of the tanking issues, Wizards obviously included in part there. But this one was more general to kind of the state of play in the game. And I'm going to do my best here to do the Hall of Famer justice, Anthony. I'd just like to read the first part of this because the writing here is excellent. You ready for my my version of events here?
Yes, sir.
Stephen Curry processed what was happening and about to happen in about a tenth of a second. In his 1009th NBA game, the future Hall of Famer curled off a screen by Kevon Looney in the fourth quarter against the Knicks in Madison Square Garden, an event game in the world's most famous arena, as they like to say. Curry already had 25 points in three-plus quarters and had four three-pointers. In other words, a typical Steph-tacular night was brewing. And the Warriors were ahead late in the game when they ran an action to one side with Curry and Looney, who've been teammates for a decade. Curry took the dribble handoff from Looney just behind the three-point line. The Knicks, of course, sold out defensively, sending three players in Curry's direction. When you hear about the gravity that Curry's historic shooting prowess creates, this is what people are talking about. He tilts the floor because you can't let him beat you one last time with one last three, because the night-night comes out afterward. The Knicks center, Mitchell Robinson, was in no man's land. If he didn't step up to Curry and challenge him, Curry would pull up for a long two or step back and launch from behind the arc. But Robinson also had to watch Looney rolling to the basket. Robinson made his choice. He took a half step towards Curry, just a half a step. That's all the space Curry needed. Curry then ended the game, not with a dagger three, but with a pocket pass between Mikal Bridges and Robinson, hitting the rolling Looney in stride for a dunk. It was gorgeous, gorgeous basketball, observant in the institutional knowledge of all five players involved, had of their opponents and one another, immediate, as Curry observed and processed and decided and executed a series of moves in a matter of moments, and efficient, as Looney rolled and dunked one of the non-three-point shots that the advanced stats community cheers. It was a Tuesday night in the NBA. It was far from unique.
That's why he's one of the best.
And I can read. This article goes on to talk about how players like Victor Wembanyama, players like Kevin Durant, are wholly unique in NBA history. The basketball player has never, ever been better. We have guys that can do everything. And sure, it might look a little different than the 90s, but or the 80s, but there's nothing that Magic Johnson could do that LeBron James can't. And there are things that LeBron James can do that Magic Johnson could not. And some of that is just pure athleticism, but it's also the way the game has evolved. And you and I were talking about this before the show, and I think it's worth mentioning that if someone like a Magic Johnson had been born in the year 2000, as opposed to whenever Magic Johnson was born, like Magic Johnson would have come up watching this NBA and he would have evolved his game. There's no doubt that in any era, because of the adaptability, skill, IQ, it's resources available relative to the time, that Magic Johnson would have been one of the greatest NBA players ever. It just so happens that his game was cemented as what it was in that time because that's what the league was at that time. He was not trying to be the best basketball player in the history of the game. He was trying to be the best basketball player in 1984 or 1987 or whenever you want to pick in Magic's career. But if you were just to take that out of it and not say what those players are capable of and just time machine it, the basketball player, because each generation learns from the one before it, and the game evolves, like Trae Young exists because of Stephen Curry on down the list, and then there's guys like Steph who are truly rare innovators in the history of the sport, we know that this skill level is higher than ever. And I think the other part of it that's interesting is the analytics and the strategy, and really the strategy, which is then based on the analytics, because it took for some reason 30 years in the NBA for them to realize that three is more than two. The sport has just so fundamentally changed strategically, and because of the ways that data science impacts the game now, has become far more homogenous in the style of play and the choices that these teams are making. And what I found so fascinating about this article was, Anthony, it kind of begs the question of, like, what do we actually want from our sports? Because I think if I were to tell a random sports fan, hey, I have for you Are you, well, one, are you a basketball fan? Yes. Two, would you like to see the best basketball that can possibly be played, the most effective version played by the best players that have ever walked the planet? And they go, yeah, of course. And I go, the NBA. And they're like, no. Figuring out for the league, and just as a guy who talks about it and is interested in this, figuring out what that disconnect is the key to the whole thing. Like, what truly do we want out of our sports? And to draw the connection that I teased coming out of the last segment, this also has to do with the torpedo bats in baseball. Some people are like, this is fine. Some people are not, because some people are fine with the innovation, and some people just want baseball to be the thing that it's been since the 1900s, because that, in part, is the actual beauty of baseball, is that unlike a lot of other sports where you can't compare eras, this is a sport where you more or less can. The statistical stuff hasn't changed that much. And if there's something that's going to completely change the thing that we love about the sport, we actually don't want that thing to happen, because it then loses what is familiar and what we love in the first place. And I think that is a question that the NBA is really struggling with, because the game has so fundamentally, like the game of basketball has so fundamentally changed over the last decade and a half, that it is unrecognizable to the people that grew up playing it if they're older than 25 years old.
Yeah, and I truly just don't understand why. I mean, even the people that analyze the game, the Charles Barkleys of the world, the Shaqs of the world, I think Kenny, to an extent, respects the game a little bit more than, you know, some of the older guys. But their job is to, you know, analyze the game. And sometimes it just comes off as, you know, them hating the game. And sometimes what they say, or like what they project, influences like how other people perceive, you know, the NBA. So it's literally like I don't know the metaphor for it, but it's tough for, I guess, the older crowds that, you know, tune into that show and then, you know, look at what we actually is out there on the NBA courts and go from there. So I don't know. It's a tough cycle, but I'm, you know, a millennial. I'm a younger guy. I grew up watching and, you know, allowing the, or just appreciating the NBA evolving. So I'm, you know, used to it. I understand it. And it just, you know, takes people to come down, have some humility, and understand that the game is going to freaking evolve.
The thing is, it's going to be, it's like, that's life.
Yeah.
The older you get, the more you understand how frustrating that can be at times. But you then have to check yourself and just be like, is this, and that's not to say that everything that is new is better. And I think that is actually the fundamental question here, is like, the players are better. The game is being played in a more efficient, effective way based off of all available data.
Mm-hmm.
But it is actually, like, at the core, the reason it's a $1 billion industry is not because of the basketball and its effectiveness. It's because it's entertaining. And so what is the responsibility of the league to put on an entertainment product? And I think Major League Baseball, to its credit, did some of this a couple of years ago. Like, this is referenced in David's piece of, they looked at these games getting way out of hand in terms of time. They saw stolen base numbers plummet, which is one of the most exciting plays in the sport. And they saw batting averages die because everyone, like, the shift was so popular, and it was so easy to predict because they had all this incredibly sophisticated, and these numbers aren't even that sophisticated, but data to say, like, these guys pull an insane amount. We can run the numbers on this. And in a lot of ways, like, as a fan of Formula One, I think one of the things that you have to fundamentally understand about Formula One is it's not a race car contest. It's an engineering contest, right? There's a reason why there are long stretches of dominance in that sport, because someone figures out something with the car. And while, yes, Max Verstappen is probably currently, as much as it pains to say me, the best driver on the planet, he's got someone else in the other car, in another car on his team, that is driving the exact same car and is finishing at the bottom of the field. Like, there's a whole thing in Formula One right now because Liam Lawson, the other Red Bull driver, just got demoted after two races because they're like, this dude can't drive this car. and they're promoting Yuki Tsunoda this weekend in Japan. But like, that's the stark difference of like, Max Verstappen is the master at that car, and when it's driven that way, it's one of the best cars on the grid. But Formula One is by nature an engineering contest. And that's why I think the torpedo bat thing is interesting, and why the current NBA discourse is interesting, is because I don't think baseball fans nor basketball fans want an engineering contest. They don't want you to look at this data and be like, oh, it's best to shoot the corner three. They want to see the game as designed. Hey, the whole point is not to shoot a bunch of threes. The whole point, as the game was initially designed, the core, the essence of basketball is player movement, ball movement, get ball close to basket, put ball in basket. And that third step of get ball close to basket is now completely obliterated because they put a line out there and then said, hey, that shot is worth more. And it took 30 years, but once people figured out just how valuable that extra point per shot was, it completely changed the game. And I think the same thing is true in baseball. People don't necessarily want to see the torpedo bat because it's different. It's not to say that it wasn't a genius idea by the Yankees, but no one goes to a baseball game to see an engineering contest. I don't want to see if you can design a defense or a bat to better win games. I want to see the players perform better. And I think that's the beauty of what is kind of captured here. It's not the point of David's article, but it's the thing that I came away thinking about is like, truly, what do we want from our sports? And I think in a sport like Formula One, we want an engineering competition. And we want to see if the teams can figure out how to get that extra 10th off per lap and become competitive, and can they make the adjustments, and can the drivers handle it, and the drama that goes in that sport. In basically every other sport, we want to see the athletes perform, and we want the athletes to decide it. And I think that's kind of what's happening on some level in the NBA is people feel like the game has been taken over by something other than who's the best player on the floor. And there's other issues with the league for sure, but I think the nerdiness of the NBA has probably diminished the interest in the product. And I don't know what to do about that in the NBA, because it's not the answer can't be to just start hiring dumb people. But I think the answer has to be somewhere in line with what baseball has done of how do we recapture what people love about the game and outlaw some of the stuff that, you know, whether that's making a dunk worth 3 points, because imagine how that changes the game. You want to reorient the geography and the geometry of the game? Make a dunk worth three. Make a layup inside the restricted area worth three. Now all of a sudden you have incentive to get there. So like, these are the things that I wonder if they're thinking about, and they definitely are thinking about, but what those rule changes are, I don't know.
Nah, I mean, what you propose would be definitely lit. Definitely pushing people more towards the basket. I forgot who we had on, but you guys were discussing that as well. And
yeah,
it's a hell of an idea.
And if you catch a body, it's an extra point.
Yeah.
Just incentivize Anthony Edwards trying to just basketball murder someone. By the way, you see his quote last night?
Which one?
Last night, if you missed it. Double best overtime. It's one of the best basketball games ever. He's like, Nikola Jokic, man, that might be the best player in the world outside of me.
Yeah.
Perfectly Anthony Edwards in the worst way. Anyway, if you got thoughts on that, give us a call. 301-230-0980. It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, and we're always live as well on the free Odyssey app. It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980. We are always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Streaming live on YouTube, too, at the Team 980, figuring out some stuff here behind the scenes. Anthony, we haven't had a chance to talk about our weekends yet. So before we get to Dave Johnson, and I want to talk to Dave about this article that DA wrote as well. I'm still a little sore from High Rocks this weekend. The good news is that we did well, although I was kind of... The time on the clock, the stopwatch, they say the stopwatch doesn't lie. The stopwatch doesn't lie. But, like, the course changed dramatically from this year to last year. And so in case you don't know, High Rocks is a fitness race where there's 8 different stations, and then you run 1,000 meters before each one. And let me tell you, running 8K and doing all the stuff I did with my legs, but running the 8K on concrete, that didn't feel very good. So my legs are still pretty sore from that. But like the transition area between the zones was significantly longer this year. So every single time that I have is better than last year, but my total time is not that much better because they just made the course longer. So that's annoying.
I mean, this was your second?
My second one.
I mean, the thing is, slight improvement, and I just feel like you'll have another shot at it, man.
Here's the thing. It was fun. I don't know. Here's the thing. I'm deciding whether or not I will have another shot at it.
Oh.
This might have been my... I can't be running on concrete, bro.
No, I feel you. I feel you, but I feel like if you wanted the... Did you get the time that you wanted, like kind of thing, that you envisioned
like,
for
that's
yourself?
The weird thing. Yes and no. All the individual stations and the running, like I I was in the ranges I wanted to be in. I didn't account for the fact that the course was going to be significant. Like, I did the math. Like, last year, we finished in, like, 119-something. This year, it was, like, 118.50. And last year, in the transition area, it was, like, 4.5 minutes. This year, it was 8. And it wasn't because we were slower. It was because it was significantly larger.
So I'll like take it as a...
on the station, if you put up like Skierg, last year Skierg, this year Rose, you look at all 8 runs, better this year than last year, except for the course layout. And I guess like, you know, it would be the difference in like running a marathon or a half marathon and one course is slightly downhill and one's uphill, but at least they're all 13.1 miles or 26.2 miles. No. This year, just we got arbitrary. It's like, oh, you have to take detours that don't count as part of the course.
Well, I view it as a success.
Yeah. I'll tell you the biggest success. I am not as sore as I was last year. Like, I'm sore. My muscles feel like they worked. My lower legs are like, ouchy. That was concrete that you ran all that mileage on. But last year, I felt like I couldn't walk. This year, I'm walking. And have been since Sunday night. Sunday night, after I ran, because I ran, the start time was like 5:20 for us. And I was pretty tired afterwards. Conked out real good. But all in all, like, the damage was not as bad this year.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope it wasn't, you know. You know what you needed to do to prepare.
Yeah.
You did that. You ate right.
Yeah.
You ran right.
Still got to figure that part out.
You prepped right.
The nutrition part was better, but it's also the late start was definitely hard. Yeah. But man, you just feel when your heart rate. My heart rate was in was in zone 5 for over 30 minutes, and was in zone 4 for another 30. So basically, an hour, my heart rate was at like 170 or higher. And there's only so good you're gonna feel during that.
Yeah,
I think that's what I'm learning is it ain't actually the nutrition. It's the intensity that just hurts. The old pain cave.
I feel for you, man.
I was in the pain cave. But I've emerged on the other side. And so now I talk about sports on the radio.
If I was ever to sign up for this race.
Yeah.
Would you do it with me?
Oh.
Just say no, Craig, because I don't want to do it.
No.
All right, good.
That would be pretty. We should find some. We should.
No.
Okay, fine. We still got to run 40s.
We do.
But it's starting to get nice out.
Real nice.
I got to get my legs back underneath me, though. We can't be doing.
Flag football season is starting, too. I'm ready, Craig.
I run like a 6.2 right now and then fall down afterwards.
I'm not going to lie. That's kind of slow.
Yeah, well, it's because my legs hurt.
Okay.
I'm not saying I'm actually 6.2 slow. Put some respect on my name.
About to say, you back there with Linnell.
Dave Johnson's next.